Joelle and Davidlis, but she won't be there today either because she's got other things to do, and it also would be hard to bring piano out to the, what is it called again, the Farmer's Market in Urbana, Lincoln Square, and they might do a Louis tune if you ask them to. I think I'd be there if I wasn't here on the radio. What do I got today? Well, I've got some Mumia Abu-Jamal instead of the Black Agenda Report, and Amy Goodman's got a column, Breaking the Sound Barrier. That's a regular feature. And then I've got too much to decide upon. I've been going to The Intercepted a lot. They did a long musical feature this week, as well as something about an activist in Chicago who works on prison abolition as a long-range strategy. Not expecting it in the near term. Might throw in a little bit about Barrett Brown. I just noticed that at the end of last month, Barrett Brown, who was in the jail for copping a plea, he was a leaker. He was actually leaking Stratfor documents, private security firms. And private security firms come up in another dimension. So I'm trying to think of a clever way to tie it all together, but maybe you'll be able to do that. But Barrett Brown was taken into custody some hours before he was going to go on the PBS NewsHour, and they said he had the conditions of his probation was parole or whatever, that he had to sign a document before he could do an interview. So freedom of speech does not pertain after you're on parole, apparently. Though they let him do a couple of interviews, and he wasn't apprised by the law enforcement people, his prison authorities, that he had to do that, because probably it sounds pretty weird, doesn't it? You're out of jail and you can't do interviews with the press. He actually won some awards for The Intercept writing on prison while he was in the slammer. I didn't find anything. What else? He might go into exile too. He says he can't seem to do his work here. Barrett Brown, that's a web exclusive from a little bit ago on Democracy Now!'s web exclusive section, which is where I'm going to go to the follow-up interview with this great woman who was on this week, and they did an exclusive afterwards in the aftermath of the abrogation of the accord. I'm still trying to find out whether the framework agreement was passed as a treaty. That was negotiated by Bush 1, if you recall, around the Rio summit time. And I'm not sure. Durbin had a perfect opportunity to bring it up, so maybe it isn't, when he was asked on Weekend Edition this morning about, passing the Paris Accord as a treaty. I don't know if the framework treaty that it's based on was passed with a supermajority in the Senate. I've been trying to find out, and nobody's talking about it, apparently, except me. All right, speaking of talking, what else do I have? A piece with James Henry on Trump and his financial carapace. He's on Plan B of the what ought to be looked into with Trump, not the so-called collusion, but all of the financial dealings that are the case with Trump. After he went belly up in 2000, he had to go to very odd and mobbed up places to get money to get his organization back together again. Which brings up sort of naturally at the Paris Summit Paris Accord Rose Garden event, he kicked it off by saying we're all with the people who are under the terrorist attack in the Philippines. So I thought there was probably a little more to discern there, because he generally doesn't talk about terrorist attacks. He didn't say anything for a while about the killings in Portland, throat slashed on the elevated. But so I looked into this resort by the airport in the Philippines, and it turns out it's a crony of Trump, Andrew Tan, has a major share of that. They had a little dispute in the past about how much it would cost to license Trump name in 2007 or so. It turns out it was not a terrorist attack. It was a crazed man who stole chips from the casino. I shouldn't laugh because he didn't, as far as I know, he didn't shoot anybody. Maybe he didn't. He was shooting TV sets, and then he was started the gaming tables on fire, and he wouldn't let anybody leave, I guess, and smoke inhalation killed a bunch of people. And then he went back to the hotel trying to figure out how he was going to cash in his chips that he had just stole, maybe realizing, there ain't no way I can do it, and shot himself. So it was not a terrorist event, but it was a good backdrop for Trump, and a lot of people probably didn't look into the details of the event, which is pretty crazed. Anyway, here's Mobia talking about Trump. He's a little more hopeful than I am about this. So James Henry, Amy Goodman, Spencer Ackerman, formerly a Guardian reporter, chatting with Jeremy Scahill. The Law and Disorder segment that has the James Henry segment from Tax Justice Network is one of his affiliations. I've played him before. He's a bright dude. And the second half is with Ray McGovern, and it's one of the most succinct summaries of the whole leak, not a hack situation. He has it from William Binney, a guy that left the NSA when they started one of their worst infringements on the Constitution after 30 years in the NSA. He was the author of Thin Threads, which was much better than Trailblazer. The Trailblazer project had much better connections. That's why they got hundreds of millions of dollars to try to do it twice. And that was done by SAIC, which has a local presence in town. It's all very complicated, and it's already connected. That's another connection to this whole private intelligence business. The Anthony Juhas interview is part two, and it's about Standing Rock, but she's done a lot of great work. And the insidiousness of this Tiger Swan, I don't know where they get these names, this outfit that was surveilling people in Standing Rock, and even in their supporters in Chicago, turns out. I don't have details and names on who they were surveilling, but this document dump that went both to The Intercept and to Anthony Juhas through Grist is very interesting stuff. And the implications about how law enforcement could use these cutouts to do stuff that they can't do themselves. It's apparently not illegal for them to surveil like this, whereas it would have been illegal for the FBI and such to do it without a court order. So it's all very nefarious and scary, which is one of the things that Spencer Ackerman says. What really will be a desperate and cornered Trump's policy? Okay, that's all by 8 minutes of frontispiece. I guess I'll play the McGovern piece tomorrow, and maybe I'll have to finish out a segment. I'll let you know where you can find it. Law and Disorder is easily findable both on the web and on Facebook, Law and Disorder Radio. But we're going to kick it off with Mumia Abu-Jamal. No longer on death row, and I guess he's getting some medical treatment for his hepatitis C, I guess it is.
The fall. It has been exceedingly difficult to write about the Trump presidency, seemingly crumbling before our eyes. In part, that's because of the sheer pace of new revelations, scandals superseded by new scandals, the inane utterances and tweets of the president, a daily cascade of craziness. Part of this is the new media, which rushes at us on a 24-hour clock with no sense of cessation. Part of it is Trump's sheer obsession with social media and his unique ability to undermine his own spokespersons with a tweet. We are in the midst of the latest reality show, The Trump Show, featuring Donald J. Trump, a manic superstar who hasn't decided whether to host a comedy or a tragedy, but has seemingly settled for farce. One recent New York Times editorial mused about being a nation ruled by a child, a petulant, ill-mannered, tantrum-prone six-year-old playing emperor of the world. In the space of a quarter of a year, Trump has led his administration into the morass of the Russia trap. His country, by the way, suffers from Trump-induced exhaustion. His party, the Trump Party, appears to be a union of maniacs. Their central program, to defend a president who seems unable or unwilling to defend himself. The corporate media, which fed from the Trump trough during the campaign, has acquired the taste for Trump flank and now competes for the biggest bombshell to bring down USS Trump. Not since Watergate have we seen such a fevered fury for the hide of a president. When I was a young college student at Goddard in Vermont, I bought a copy of the New York Times in the local general store. There was a very tiny article on the first page on the failed burglary at the Watergate Hotel. Who knew that such a small thing would topple a president? It now looks quaint compared to the things we see before us now. This is bigger, bolder, uglier, more crass. This smells of corruption, of capitalist greed and excess, and of imperial arrogance on a grand global scale. This feels like the beginning of the end. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And I think she does good work. Again, Mumia Abu-Jamal, not on slow death row since he's getting treatment. He was a stringer for WHYY, Home of Fresh Air, NPR in Philly, as well as writing for a paper. He was doing a lot of exposés of the police. I think actually the dirty police that got taken out a little bit later. I'm going to just keep talking and not jump to the phone. You should be listening to the radio to know when to call, I guess. We don't have a staff here. So hang up and call back. How about that for a nice sound? Yeah, they took out both the Faulkner, who was going to rat on some cops, and one of their major critics in the African-American community at the same time. So that's my theory of the case. There's some evidence to it. But he ought to at least have a retrial. Anyway, it's already 13 minutes in, so here's Amy Goodman's commentary of the week, Breaking the Sound Barrier. And you'll be hearing her a little bit later. Hopefully I have that up. Yeah, I do.
90 people. We need to know their names. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. A suicide bomb blast in Kabul, Afghanistan, killed at least 90 people and injured over 450 this week. Hidden in a tanker truck, the bomb is likely one of the largest ever set off in Kabul. It left a crater 13 feet deep and broke windows over a mile away. Among those killed were two media workers, Aziz Navin of the 24-hour Afghan cable news channel Tolo News, and Mohammad Nazir, a driver for the BBC. The death toll continues to climb as additional bodies are found, and some who were injured succumb to their wounds. Details of those killed are sparse, while the Manchester bombing 9 days earlier garnered wall-to-wall coverage on the corporate news networks with in-depth biographies of the victims. Kabul, with the death toll over four times as high, with hundreds injured, gets mentioned only in brief reports, the dead and injured listed as numbers rather than names.
It was 8:30 in the morning, and I was in my office when I it shook the building. I thought it was an earthquake. And then there was a huge blast.
That's Latfullah Najafizadeh, news director for Tolo News, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
What happened today is definitely a tragic and a huge attack, especially when most of them are civilians, working class people.
Latfullah recounted how they found their co-worker, Aziz Navin, on Wednesday morning.
We had to go and find his dead body among over 50 dead bodies, which were at the hospital, two hospitals, by noon. And most of the bodies were burned to death. And some bodies, you could just see a few body parts available beyond recognition. It was very, very tragic and barbaric attack.
Tolo News was attacked last year in January of 2016. Seven colleagues were targeted and killed while riding together in a van. Led by Latfullah, the Tolo team debated whether to give up their jobs to avoid future attacks.
We talked to all of our colleagues, and over 90% of them were under immense family pressures to quit their jobs. But over 90% of them in the same time decided to stay and told us that now we should continue firmly and continue with even greater dedication and commitment.
The Kabul attack on Wednesday took place in what's considered one of the city's safest neighborhoods, with many embassies, security checkpoints, gates and blast walls. Nevertheless, the size of the bomb and its detonation at a crowded intersection during the morning rush hour inflicted massive casualties, almost all of them civilian. Each of these deaths is tragic. We ought to know not only the number of those killed, but also their names, their life stories. The reporting on the May 22nd bomb attack at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, was immediate and comprehensive. As names were released, print, TV, and online news outlets offered an extensive biography of each victim. The Manchester Evening News launched a fundraising webpage that's raised almost $3 million for the families of those killed and for the wounded in that bombing. These are appropriate responses, to be sure. Without the wall-to-wall coverage of the Kabul attack, there is no comparable outpouring of compassion for its victims. War should never be normalized. It should never become routine. We need to see the images. Only then will war become unacceptable, intolerable. Aziz Navin was walking to work at Tolo News, where he provided IT support. He was 22 years old. We know from his Facebook profile that he was an avid photographer and a fan of the Liverpool Football Club. He was a student at the American University of Afghanistan and also worked as a systems administrator at a Kabul-based web hosting company, Navinhost. Tolo News co-workers attended his funeral the same day of the bombing and also posted a story about him with moving images from the funeral. The other media worker killed, Mohammed Nazir, was remembered by a BBC colleague, Wahid Massoud, who wrote, "Mohammed Nazir was young. He was the father of four children and the only breadwinner in his family. He had a gentle smile and a warm personality." Late reports suggest the Kabul bombing was committed by the Haqqani Network, an Afghan insurgent group with help from the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI. We may never know who's to blame, nor, sadly, are we likely to learn the names and the life stories of the victims. Aziz Navin's favorite quote, posted on his Facebook page, was, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, I'm waiting for somebody to call it the mother of all truck bombs. But Amy didn't. Maybe she thought better of it. 20 minutes after the hour, just looking up, we're trying a new show called Monitor. I've been playing segments out of it. Host is Mark Badawi. He seems to be on a little hiatus because he's got a program that's developed from a documentary from the UK from 2002. It's a television series called The Century of the Self, and it looks into psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud and Anna Freud and PR consultant Edward Bernays, who actually is a relative of a descendant of Freud, about the manufacture of consent, I guess, as Chomsky put it, the idea that, well, I don't actually, that's what PR consultant Bernays was about. They're maybe doing a series of these. There's actually 4 episodes. But you can Google that, and you can listen to the audio from some outtakes from it in the next hour. Monitor out of KPFT, Pacifica, blown off the air twice in the Vietnam era by Ku Klux Klanners, who weren't against the anti-war sentiment. They were against the race mixing. But they blew up the tower twice, not the studio. So don't get any ideas. I think we're going to start with Jeremy Scahill and his segment from Intercepted. As I mentioned, they have a long interview with a prison abolitionist who hangs her hat in Chicago now. Jeremy Scahill has some roots in Chicago, and I don't know if it comes up in this segment or not. They sort of step on their outro line, so I'll try and amplify it, which is as usual, there's this sort of phantasmagoric intro. The first one, I guess, was Alice in Wonderland, and it's gotten stranger ever since. Heart of Darkness, riff, Twin Peaks. See if I hit the right button here. You can find this at The Intercepted or go to intercept.org, I guess, and look for the podcast. Look for it on your local podcast servers if you do that kind of thing. Though, listen to the radio. Robert Perry, got a little segment of that, too. I might not get to that today. He's the guy from Consortium News that I go to. About a lot of analysis for Inside the Beltway, along with Gareth Porter, probably my most two common folks. But Jeremy Scahill and Guardian reporter now with the Daily Beast.
The country. I have total confidence in him.
I don't know. I never killed anything before.
If you can't produce peace,
it's about
in the
son-in-law.
Nobody can.
Son-in-law, rated PG-13. Sneak preview Sunday, June 20th. Check newspaper for showtime.
My view of it is I don't like it.
You have got charisma!
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 17 of Intercepted.
Stronger we're getting. Have you feeling it? Are you feeling it? All that new equipment is coming in. You saw what we did with our military budget, way up. Took a little heat on that one, but it's okay with me.
What a strange world we all inhabit. Donald Trump attacks traditional U.S. allies from his Twitter account, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel hits back from a Bavarian beer hall. The brief hiatus Trump took from Twitter aggression while he was abroad, loving on the Saudis and Israelis, hating on the Europeans and NATO, that's come to a screeching halt. And Trump is back to his tweeting and to his old ways. The scandals that plagued Trump, however, have not abated. If anything, they're intensifying. The spotlight right now, and it's an ever-shifting spotlight, seems to have moved a bit from General Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, and landed on Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And the focus is on reports that Kushner secretly commiserated with Russian officials to set up some sort of a back channel that would evade the snooping ears and eyes of even U.S. intelligence. We're going to dig into all of that in a moment. But first, I just wanted to say a word about Trump and NATO. This public kerfuffle between Trump and Merkel and other European NATO powers, in the media, it's centered around Trump sort of sticking his thumb in the eyes of European allies and lashing out at them for not paying enough money to support NATO, not contributing enough forces to be used in various wars. The cable networks love to show the reaction of other world leaders to Trump's theatrics. And I'll admit, some of it was pretty damn funny.
Video from the NATO summit in Belgium. President Trump appears to shove aside the Prime Minister of Montenegro to get to the front of the group. Talk about putting America first.
But what gets lost in all of this, and this is true of the way Trump is covered in general, is that NATO is not just some like benevolent force in the world. NATO is often, when you want to boil it down to it, a militaristic arm of U.S. hegemony. It's used at times to circumvent United Nations authorities to conduct legally dubious military actions. NATO has been used for regime change and for offensive wars. NATO is an alliance, for the most part, of powerful white Western countries and their leaders and their governments defending their so-called free market economic policies. There should be a debate about NATO. There should be a debate about NATO, the US, and Europe, but not the one that Trump and Merkel and the other European leaders are having. And that's sort of indicative of the moment that we're in. Whatever stupid Trump says or does, the latest gaffe or embarrassment, that consumes so much media attention. That and the various palace intrigues and the Russia investigation. Take a step back and consider who benefits from all of this chicanery. Among the chief beneficiaries is without a doubt the national security state in this country. Trump doesn't want to bother himself with the detailed intel briefings. He wants pictures. He wants his name written into each sentence so that he pays attention to it. But Trump has told the CIA that they get everything that they want, everything that they need.
I want to just let you know, I am so behind you. And I know maybe sometimes you haven't gotten the backing that you've wanted, and you're going to get so much backing. Maybe you're going to say, please don't give us so much backing. Mr. President, please, we don't need that much backing.
The CIA is an agency that thrives when there is no meaningful oversight. In a way, Trump and his kind of lazy approach to intelligence and oversight, Trump's taking the CIA back to the glory days before the Church Commission and the U.S. military, too. It's now operating with far less restraint and rules than existed under President Obama, who gave the military quite a bit of latitude in his own right.
Just moments ago, there was another new round of airstrikes in Yemen overnight following that January raid that killed Navy SEAL Ryan.
Activists say at least 106 people have been killed by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in the Syrian province.
U.S. Air Force dropped a 21,000-pound bomb in eastern Afghanistan, the first use ever of this weapon in combat.
When it comes to military operations under President Donald Trump, the generals are calling the shots, and they are pushing the envelope.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
You now have boots on the ground, raids happening in Yemen, huge numbers of civilians being killed as the U.S. intensifies its operations in Syria and Iraq. Now there's going to be another surge inside of Afghanistan. These institutions, the CIA, the military, they fiercely defend their turf. And they're not going to want to give back an inch when whoever succeeds Trump gets into office. Just something to consider as we chase the rabbit in all of these Trump scandals. But we do have to chase the rabbit to a degree. We have to cover these stories. Why? Because these are the things, the Russia stuff, the emoluments, what deals Trump has made in secret. Those are the things that may actually end this presidency if he doesn't die or quit. Or at least they could end the tenure of some very high-profile advisors and associates of Trump. Kushner, Jared Kushner, who is sort of like, he's like Trump's less savvy Tom Hagen, you know, the consigliere to Don Corleone.
I have a special practice. I handle one client. Now you have my number, I'll wait for your call.
He's a rich kid who married another rich kid whose dad became president. And Jared Kushner, the little rich kid who married the other rich kid, he's now making decisions that impact the lives of hundreds of millions, potentially billions of people around the world. Well, young Jared is now facing scrutiny and potential serious investigation over allegations that he tried to set up this secret communication pipeline with the Russians. To defend Kushner over the weekend, the Trump administration wheeled out Homeland Security Secretary General John Kelly.
I think any time you can open lines of communication with anyone, whether they're good friends or not so good friends, is a smart thing to do.
Now, depending on what we learn about Jared's actual conversations regarding this secret channel, General Kelly may live to regret his defense of this kid. And now we also understand that Jared was one of the key people urging President Trump to fire FBI Director James Comey. And that raises a whole other set of issues. Why did Jared push for that? Is there an innocent explanation, or did they know part of what was coming? Well, Jared is now lawyered up. Trump is lawyering up. There's now an independent investigator in the form of former FBI Director Robert Mueller. To talk about all of this, I'm joined now by Spencer Ackerman. He was, of course, part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the Guardian newspaper that covered the initial Edward Snowden revelations. Of course, Glenn Greenwald, one of our co-founders, also a part of that. Spencer is now the senior national security correspondent at the Daily Beast. Spencer, welcome to Intercepted.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Let's start with the most recent news about Jared Kushner and the reports that he opened or sought to open a secret line of communication with Moscow before Trump actually became president. The story goes it would have involved going into the Russian embassy and communicating with them. The White House now says that the point of that had to do with coordinating Syria policy. What's your analysis of what's happening right now with Jared Kushner?
It strikes me that Kushner would have no idea that his interactions with Russian officials would be monitored, that this would be one of the premier intelligence collection targets in the United States, that whatever the Russians would have, whether it's Kislyak talking back to his superiors or through a different channel, be highly attractive for interception, would require no legal pretext. It's already, you know, baked into the pie there. So if anyone was going to do this, it strikes me that Kushner is the plausible candidate to do this. You know, with someone like Mike Flynn, it becomes harder to understand how someone who, you know, spent his career in the bowels of this system could have been that reckless. I guess we have to say allegedly that reckless. But with Kushner, particularly given depth of experience in international business deals of being part of the Trump entourage as well as on his own, that he would have probably thought he could just have this sort of freedom of movement, this ease of communication. The really shocking thing is that if the story is true, and you know it's going to be heavily investigated in the months, if not years to come, you know, the salient part isn't the back channel itself. It's making sure that there wouldn't be any record of it going back to the U.S. intelligence agencies and other formal channels. When back channels are typically set up, the way they work is that those people inside the intelligence community are precisely the ones who actually do know that this is going on. That the most salient distinction between previous back channels and whatever this turns out to be, what's being discussed here with Kushner, is that he wants to make sure that the U.S. side, including those aspects of the U.S. intelligence community that particularly at the point in time at which this is supposed to have occurred, are really spun up about counterintelligence risks, don't know that it's happening.
How unusual are all of the things that we're hearing about in the Trump administration? The calls that Flynn had, the possibility that Jared Kushner was trying to set up this back channel, the Russians showing up at the RNC and meeting with all of these people that ended up either in the White House or being very close to Trump.
The Russians showing up at the RNC is probably the most, for lack of a better term, normal aspect of everything that you just mentioned. Again, the really significant part of this Kushner story is that precisely the people who are supposed to know about this so that it doesn't appear on its face to be, you know, frankly, the Russians flipping someone or someone, if you or I were to walk into a Russian embassy, if we were to walk into a Russian aligned intelligence facility, if we were to walk into a Russian restaurant where we knew that there were several different layers of contact protected through plausible deniability and said, I want to set up a mechanism of communication. I want to make sure that, you know, people who might be interested in it on the American side don't know about it. And by the way, I'm connected to the most powerful person in the world by marriage. In intelligence circles, that's typically understood as a walk-in. That's typically understood as someone deciding that they want to play ball with a hostile or at least foreign intelligence service. which would kind of, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, get you in kind of like the bright line territory of probable cause to get your communications intercepted, even outside of this particular arrangement. So when we hear reports that the president's son-in-law is trying to make sure that there's a communications channel that U.S. intelligence doesn't know about, that's highly, highly suspect to those inside the intelligence agencies, and sets off a process that would be probably charitably described as a debate about whether there is a policy aspect to it or whether this becomes something much more clandestine and, for lack of a better term, sinister or at least suspect.
In the time we have left, I wanted to also ask you what you think is going to come of Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian efforts to interfere in the U.S. election. And do you think there will be indictments of Trump circle people? I mean, is Flynn going to get indicted? Do they have enough goods on him?
I mean, I really don't know. I'm as fascinated by this question as you are and as everyone else is. I wish I could say that I had the visibility into this investigation and wish to sort of speak confidently.
What's
on
the
it.
Most damning thing that you've seen of all of this? You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the difference between smoke and fire, but what is the most damning path that you could go down in terms of there with Trump or his people?
I think straight up, on just on its face, whatever it is that you think about Jim Comey, and I don't think Comey could ever read my reporting and say that I'm a fan of Jim Comey. The moment that he has an active investigation into the president of the United States and the president of the United States' allies, and the president fires the FBI director, that's just on its face obstruction of justice. Now with this Kushner story, it also looks on the face of it that a contributing factor to Trump trying to get Comey to stifle this investigation is to protect the president's son-in-law. Trump seems to have, no matter what, an affinity for Mike Flynn.
General Flynn is a wonderful man. I think he's been treated very, very unfairly by the media, as I call it, the fake media in many cases.
You know, to be maximally charitable, Flynn was a guy who gave Trump military credibility at a time when he had none. Nevertheless, he keeps on going back and back and back to Flynn. We know he visited Russian intelligence. He was at a really weird RT dinner with Vladimir Putin. Something's going on. Something is just there. Whatever it is, there are too many data points for it to seem like this is all, you know, fake news. So now that we hear about this off-the-books Kushner back channel, one of the things that I think it was the Washington Post that noted a few short weeks after this supposed back channel conversation gets entered into between Kushner and Kislyak, your old buddy Eric Prince actually acts as a Trump back channel. How paranoid should we be? How paranoid should I be that someone with such extensive experience in running a paramilitary private company is kind of a go-to Trump guy? Like, you know, at my most paranoid, I'm asking, like, is this Trump's contingency plan? Are we going to see, like, you know, whatever in the world Trump's, you know, current company is called now? You know,
you mean Prince's or Trump's?
Prince's.
Trump's is called the United States.
Trump's is called the United States, and it's definitely called Trump. The best I've ever been owned on Twitter.
They get a little jocular there and step on the line, which they it doesn't finish his dark view. Maybe that's a way of coping of paramilitary solutions. And that is a subject of the reportage on The Intercept and also at Grist with Anthony Juhas. I guess I'll get to a segment of that since I couldn't put a sock in it. Did want a couple of community announcements here. There's actually a nice list of one after the other all this coming week, if you have time for this kind of stuff. There's a listening session with Carol Ammons, happy birthday again, at the Champaign Library, Sunday 2 to 4 in the afternoon. She's getting people's concerns. She's talking about going to the federal level, maybe, but she wants to know about the 103rd as well. That's our district. There's a town hall, Protect the Middle Fork, about this coal ash deposit up along the only federally recognized scenic river. I think there's some in southern Illinois that just haven't been federally recognized. They should be, because maybe that would stop the frack. But anyway, this is actually over in Danville. I think there's one coming up for here as well. Some of our state representatives will be there. Chad Hayes, Scott Bennett, Danville Mayor, Revillian County Board. Apparently there's an article in today's News Gazette, according to one of the organizers, the Eco Justice Collaborative, people that are helping put this on. That's one of the things they're working on, is this coal ash time bomb, as it were. Anyway, for people out in our eastern listening area, maybe, or somebody wants to drive over to Danville, check on this. Okay, I think I better move on and play a little of James Henry from Law and Disorder. Again, the second segment is Ray McGovern, and he's very cogent in this interview. He's the one who says if the NSA, if there were actual Russian hacks of various DNC, et cetera, that the NSA would be able to document that with their trace routes or whatever they're called. And if since they haven't done it and they haven't shared it with the people on the Intelligence Committee, as it's called in the Congress, because they keep saying we haven't seen anything hard evidence, that would be hard evidence. There's a guy named Schindler, a disgraced guy, ex-NSA. He was doing the Wiener dick pics with some people and was forced to resign over that and some other issues. It's saying, well, they do have the evidence. When are they going to show it? But anyway, that's Ray McGovern. You can go to raymcgovern.com and maybe there'll be a link. But you can find Law and Disorder both on the web and the Facebook, Law and Disorder Radio, I guess it is. But Robert Perry tomorrow, maybe Ray McGovern. That's a common combination. They've anyway, it's now time for me to let my fingers do the walking here and listen to some of this James Henry. Interview, and that would be this one here. Yeah, I'm going to hear just a segment of this too. I would commend it to your attention. He again was with Tax Justice Network out of the UK. There's one locally, but they aren't as active. There's a monthly podcast of Tax Justice that I've sampled, and I recommend it. So, but here's Michael Smith interviewing James Henry.
That this has been unearthed, and the claim has yet to be substantiated. Last week, former FBI Director Robert Mueller was named to head an investigation of Trump's ties to Russia. If this investigation goes wide, it will look into Trump's economic connections with billionaire Russians. In 2008, Donald Trump Jr. said wealthy Russians were the most important investors in his father's businesses. Our guest today, Attorney James Henry, an economic investigative reporter, has written that after Donald Trump's many bankruptcies, he was able to finance his businesses with funds from billionaire Russian oligarchs who had amassed great wealth, appropriating Russian natural resources and industries, including gold, oil, natural gas, electricity, auto, and aluminum. When the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, publicly owned resources were taken over by private owners. Some $1.3 trillion was taken out of the country and used by these oligarchs in foreign investments, including Trump's properties. It is therefore a possibility that an investigation of Donald Trump will show that he violated U.S. laws against racketeering, money laundering, and association with organized crime figures. Attorney James Henry is a senior fellow at the Columbia University Center on Sustainable Investment. He's also a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University. Attorney Henry is a member of the New York Bar and a cooperating attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Civil Liberties Union. He joins us today Attorney James Henry, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning.
Jim, I want to ask you about your history and background. You do what's called investigative economics reporting. How does your approach differ from conventional investigative journalism?
Well, my background is not only law, but also economics. Way back to the 1970s, when I was a graduate student at Harvard, I was interested in the question of the underground economy and how large it was, how fast it was growing. And I developed the first methods using observations of how much cash is outstanding, U.S. currency, to estimate that. And that led to a kind of a long-term interest in estimating things that are just not that easy to measure. Kind of like the equivalent of measuring the size of a black hole in astrophysics, where you have to kind of back into indirectly to look at the size of, let's say, you know, drug trafficking or capital flight or tax evasion or any of the other subjects I've written about. So in my professional career, I went off and spent a good bit of time in the mainstream corporate sector. I was chief economist at a global consulting firm called McKinsey. I went to work for as a vice president of strategy at Lotus, the software company in Boston, and sort of paid my dues in that world. But I maintained a strong interest in investigative economics all along, and was continuing to write books and articles about this kind of subject on the side. So I wrote a lot for The Nation, for The New Republic, and for a number of books in this area. One, Basic Books 2005, called The Blood Bankers, which is about where the money went that was loaned to developing countries during the 1970s and 80s. And I, in pursuing that story, I went to 8 different developing countries and did kind of audits of the foreign debt. So looking closely at where the loans that were made to the Marcos regime in the Philippines, to the Brazilian dictatorship and Mexico. And this is what I mean by investigative economics. This is not sitting in the armchair and developing models to theorize about economic reality, but actually going out looking at concrete puzzles, relatively simple questions like, where did the money go? Why is there so much capital flight coming out of various countries like Russia and China? This requires actually getting out there and interviewing people and talking and also using kind of the data very creatively, knowing a lot about where it comes from.
Let's talk about Russia. Where does the overall investigation of the Trump-Russia situation stand? What are its main elements?
Well, if we step back to the election, which is kind of one of the predicate acts for all of the interest in this, I would say that, the interest in President Trump's relationship with Putin really took a long time for the U.S. media to focus on. And it was really only kind of in the aftermath of the election that people woke up and discovered, hey, there had been kind of a systematic effort on the part of Putin and some of his circle to manipulate the outcome of the election. So they certainly seem to have provided assistance to the hacking of the DNC. I mean, that's a controversial claim, but it's basically 17 U.S. intelligence agencies have said that. We don't always believe them, but there is in this case, I think, strong evidence that the Russians were trying to have an impact, and we certainly know where they stood on the issues. So that there's a whole lot of investigation that has been done since the election on the basis of the so-called collusion theory. I call that kind of theory one. My focus has been on a different and sort of much more observable phenomenon, which is the extraordinary number of private connections that Donald Trump used over time to kind of finance his recovery after the year 2000. And a lot of these connections were with extraordinary number of kleptocrats, oligarchs, and outright mobsters who came from the Russia or the former Soviet Union. And so this story is really more about organized crime, and it's more about, you know, kind of a, you know, his involvement in a series of projects that appear to have involved money laundering. And, you know, it's kind of like project after project that we look at has the same basic pattern. And that's the focus of my work. That's theory two. I wish that theory had more emphasis on the part of the Congress and the Senate. But even the latest terms of reference for the special prosecutor who's been appointed, Robert Mueller, really are focusing on theory one, the collusion theory. And since that is intrinsically, you know, secret, and the evidence is transcripts and phone calls and actual classified intelligence, it's a lot harder for independent investigators to get a handle on it. You know, you really need the subpoena power of Congress or the FBI or other organizations that have that kind of access to do that work. So I've been focusing very much on the second theory, and I think we can go much farther toward that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Today, for example, the headline on the front page of the New York Times said, "Russia Trump, the big concern of ex-CIA chief," and then they go on to quote Brennan, John Brennan, the ex-CIA right. chief, and he says he acknowledged that he did not know whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russian operatives and said the contacts might have been benign. And then he conceded later on that there's no evidence that they influenced the election campaign. So I think if we're talking about pay dirt, we're really talking about what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's evidence that, you know, there's an extraordinary number of and weird contacts that they have. That certainly adds up. I mean, all the stuff that was going on with Flynn and Manafort and, you know, Carter Page. And I mean, there's a lot of allegations there. There's a lot of smoke pouring out of that basement. But I don't want to say that there's no evidence, but certainly Brennan's right. You know, they haven't been able to share it with the public, so we haven't been able to, you know, take a hard look at it. The kind of stuff I'm focusing on is very much more subject to, you know, kind of breaking it down by project. There was a very good article in the New Yorker. There were the Adam Davidson took a hard look at the Trump Tower in Baku, which you know, Trump to finance that failed project, he turned to some oligarchs in Azerbaijan, and, you know, people with a history of financing all kinds of shady business. And looking at the Trump Soho in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, well, that's dear to my heart because I used to live in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that building goes up 46 stories.
That's right.
In a neighborhood where you have 3- and 4- and 5-story buildings. And it just towers over everything. And it became to me a symbol of a lot about what is so detestable about Trump. And then when I started reading your articles about it, I was really quite amazed. Talk to us about who the investors are in that building.
Right. Well, the Trump Soho is a great example of exactly what we're talking about here. It's a real estate development company called Bayrock. Was founded in the early 2000s by a former Kazakhstan Soviet trade minister, a fellow who turned out to be a twice convicted felon, once for assault and another for a $40 million financial fraud. Now, this is a guy named Felix Sater. Unbeknownst to any of the investors in the Bayrock project, which in which Trump owned about 18% of the Trump Soho, and Bayrock was the primary developer there. These guys were in the background, and you know, whether Trump knew their identities is disputed. He claims not, but as partner, he had to sign off on all the terms of the investment. It looks to many people like this project, which ultimately went bankrupt in 2014, you know, was just a kind of a scam to begin with. So, you know, that's one of a dozen such projects around the world, at least a dozen, where there was heavy involvement of former Soviet Union money. There was this pattern of the project failing after 2-3 years And it turns out that many of the actors involved had shady backgrounds. We look now at the latest revelations of the Wall Street Journal about the Toronto Tower, which is the tallest building in Canada, also went bankrupt last year. Turns out that the key partner in that deal was the beneficiary of a $800 million loan from a Putin-owned bank, VEB Bank of Russia, who bought this guy's assets just before he invested with Trump. Panama Hilton, Panama Ocean Club project, which is still going on, was, turns out was financed partly with Colombian drug money. So, again and again, I mean, the question of whether Trump has actually committed any financial crimes here is an important one, but, he is the president, and there's an impeachment process that you have to go to. The statute of limitations for money laundering in the U.S. is 10 years. So a lot of these projects date back to, 2006, 2007, and that statute is probably going to run out even if he wasn't president. So, we may be looking at, kind of losing the opportunity to actually hold him criminally liable for, defrauding investors or for engaging in money laundering. But it's pretty clear, just from the evidence, that, after the year 2000, Trump was basically unfinanceable. He had had six bankruptcies in the 1990s. No U.S. bank would lend to him. The only international bank that would lend to him was Deutsche Bank, and they, have very strong, Russian connections. They were just tagged with a $650 million fine for laundering $10 billion of Russian organized crime money. But the only bank that would lend to Trump was this dodgy German bank, and these, GARCs and kleptocrats from the former Soviet Union who, wanted to get their money out of Russia or were working in collaboration with the Russian government in terms of having influence. So, again, in terms of bringing it back to the original question was, what is investigative economics? We started with a simple question, how did Trump recover from his financial disasters in the 1990s? How was he able to finance himself? And the short answer was, he was a beneficiary of more than $1.3 trillion of Russian flight capital that poured out of Russia, and a lot of which, was looking for projects without much discrimination about how good they were economically. And, Trump got, tens of millions of dollars to finance his recovery after the year 2000. A good example is his house in Palm Beach that he sold to a Russian oligarch in 2008, just as real estate prices had collapsed, for $95 million, having paid just $41 million in 2004. And this guy suddenly showed up out of the blue and was willing to pay all this money, even as real estate prices were plummeting in the U.S. market. A few years later, he had to sell a lot of it for a loss. So, that just seemed to be kind of another example of where Trump was able to profit from Russian flight capital.
How did you get started on this story, and what new findings have you come up with?
Boy, that's a nice question to leave hanging in the air. That's James Henry. I think he's written about it. He's with the Tax Justice Network, but this is some investigative economic investigation that he's doing, economic journalism, what the Wall Street Journal ought to be doing, I suppose. Speaking of other sources for journalism, there's a group out of Amsterdam called Zembla, Z-E-M-B-L-A, and they have a documentary called The Dubious Friends of Donald Trump. It's a series. There's one on the diamond trade, but there's one on the Russian connection. It starts out with the usual stuff about collusion, but then it gets into this Bayrock slimy deal and the other slimy deals. It's quite worth your attention. I think you can just Z-E-M-B-L-A, Google that. A friend of mine who lived in Amsterdam for a long time has good connections over there, apparently, and found out about it. Anyway, it's time to go. There's some good musical offerings tonight. Mine is on the list is Saturday Jazz with a group pulled together, including Ryan Tomsky's. The piano player is going up to Mackinac Island play at the Grand Hotel. So if you're going up there, say hi to Ryan. This is his last gig in town over the summer. And he's paired up with Tanya Combs and a number of other great players to do some Saturday evening jazz at the Iron Post. And it's 11 o'clock straight up. Got a little underwriting announcement. I decided to do yoga.